Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
As you may know, Aquinas is one of the most important and original thinkers of the Middle Ages. His contributions to virtually every area of medieval philosophy and theology, and in particular, his success at bringing the philosophy of Aristotle into harmony with Christian theology, made him enormously influential during his own lifetime and helped to shape the development of much medieval thought after him. One of the things I'll be trying to convince you of today is that we have a lot to learn from Aquinas about human nature and death, even though, or maybe even because, what he has to say on this topic is so bound up with the details of his specifically Christian theology. Now, in order to clarify my talk, as well as to bring out its practical significance, it will be helpful to get before our minds certain obvious truths or truisms. Here's the first. As human beings, we possess bodies. Indeed, as humans, we possess bodies of a distinctive type, namely living bodies or organisms, where these are bodies composed of such parts as hands, heads, arms, legs, atoms, molecules, cells, tissues, organs, and organ systems. As human beings, we also possess minds or souls. This too is an obvious truth, at least if we take minds or souls broadly enough to include whatever it is that makes us alive and endows us with the capacity for rational thought and volition. The third truism is that as human beings, we are mortal and hence will someday die. Immaterial persons, if there are any, such as God and the angels, are traditionally said to be immortal and hence incapable of death. In this respect, we differ from all such persons. We're not only capable of dying, but naturally disposed to die. That's the point of saying we're mortal. And just so you know, I'll be following the tradition here in thinking of death intuitively as the separation of the mind or soul from the body. So these three truisms raise a host of philosophical issues. Some of the most important or intriguing of these cluster around the following three interrelated groups of questions. First, human minds and bodies. What is the nature of our minds or souls and bodies, and how are they related to both to each other and to us? The questions in this first group are perhaps the most fundamental of all. At very least, getting clear about their answers will be necessary for making progress with respect to our next group of questions about human nature. How exactly are we to understand our nature as human beings? Are we fundamentally material beings, immaterial beings, or some combination of both? And of course, these first two groups of question are directly related to those in the third and final group, namely about human death. What happens to us at death? Evidently, we cease to be alive, but does this entail that we cease to exist altogether, or do we somehow survive our death? In the remainder of my talk, I want to explore Aquinas' answers to these groups of questions, these three groups of question. And I want to do so by comparing his answers with those that have been given by proponents of some other, more familiar conceptions of human beings. In contemporary philosophy, it's standard to distinguish two main conceptions of human nature, namely materialism and substance dualism, based on the different types of answers they give to our mind-body questions. Eventually, we'll see that it's worth distinguishing a third possible conception here, one that's not always kept distinct from the other two. But for now, we can begin by focusing on just the standard conceptions, and in particular, materialism. According to materialism, human beings are wholly material beings. Thus, they can be said to have material parts, like arms, legs, cells, tissues, and so on. But no immaterial parts, and certainly no immaterial minds or souls. Nowadays, materialists tend to avoid all talk of the soul, and some have gone so far as to deny that human beings even have minds. But for our purposes, it will be useful to focus on a version of materialism that identifies human beings with their bodies and human minds with the brain. Indeed, for our purposes, it will be useful to think of materialism in terms of the five claims which I've listed at C on your handout. These are claims M1 through M5 for materialism, claim 1, and so on. So the first claim is there's exactly one type of substance required to account for our human nature, namely wholly material substances. Second claim, our bodies are wholly material substances. Claim 3, our minds are brains. Claim 4, we're identical to our bodies and we possess our minds as wholly material parts. And it follows from these first four claims that we are by nature wholly material beings. For the sake of clarity, we can also illustrate this conception pictorially using Aquinas' favorite example of a human being, namely Socrates. So here's my Microsoft Word drawing of Socrates' body. There's Socrates' mind. Socrates' body is a material substance. His mind is a material part, namely a brain. Socrates is identical. Oh, that's the connection between Socrates' mind and his body, and it just indicates that it's a part of it. Socrates himself is identical to his body. So much for materialism. Let's now turn to the second main conception of human beings, substance dualism. Unlike materialists, substance dualists appeal to two different types of substance to account for our nature of human beings. One material, the other immaterial, hence their dualism. Like materialists, substance dualists identify human bodies with wholly material substances, but unlike them, they identify human minds or souls with wholly immaterial substances. And they identify human beings themselves with their minds or souls. For the sake of contrast with materialism, we can also think of substance dualism in terms of five claims, namely those I've listed at D on the handout. And here you'll see we get a similar set of claims, but the differences come in respect to the first. There are two types of substance required to account for our nature as human beings, one material, one immaterial. Our bodies are wholly material substances. That's the same as on materialism. Our minds or souls are wholly immaterial substances. That's an important difference. The fourth claim, we're identical to our minds or souls and possess our bodies by exercising control over them, by being causally, having causal power over them. And it follows from this that we are by nature wholly immaterial beings. And once again, we can illustrate this conception pictorially for the particular case of Socrates. So here's his body, there's his soul. Once again, his body is a material substance. His soul is now an immaterial substance. The relation between them is one of causation, and Socrates is identical with his soul. Substance dualism is a conception of human beings that goes back at least to Plato. Indeed, Aquinas just thinks of this as the Platonic view. Nowadays, however, it's more common to associate this conception with Descartes. Indeed, it's often referred to simply as Cartesian dualism. It's worth noting, however, that there is another conception of human nature distinct from both materialism and substance dualism, which is sometimes associated with Descartes. According to this conception, which we can refer to as trialism, because it invokes three different types of substance, human beings are identified not with their souls or with their bodies, but rather with a type of complex substance composed of each. For the sake of completeness, let's characterize trialism in terms of five claims, namely those at E on the handout. So now we get as our first claim, there are three types of substance required to account for our nature as human beings. Wholly material substances, wholly immaterial substance, and a third type, a complex substance composed of each. Once again, our bodies are wholly material substances, and like the dualists, our minds or souls are wholly immaterial substance. But now we're being identified with, according to this fourth claim, complex substances composed of both bodies and minds, and we possess both of those things as parts. It follows from these four claims that we are, by nature, partly material and partly immaterial beings. Thus, in the case of Socrates, we have three substances: his body, which is a material substance, his soul, which is an immaterial substance, and Socrates himself, which is a complex substance composed of, or having as parts, his body and mind. And his mind or soul and body are connected in such a way as to, they're united in such a way as to generate this complex substance. Okay, so having distinguished these three traditional conceptions, we can now turn to the million-dollar question, which is best? Of the three, I think it's fair to say that materialism is the dominant contemporary conception of human nature, at least among philosophers. And this shouldn't be surprising, I think, given the prevalence of naturalism, that is, the view that everything that exists, or at least all of contingent reality, is wholly material. It's important to see, however, that as a theory of human beings, materialism has a lot going for it, quite apart from any connection to naturalism. In particular, it has some significant general theoretical virtues. And to indicate benefits or virtues, I'll use the color blue. In a little bit, we'll see negative features will be marked by red. But materialism is theoretically parsimonious. It posits only a single type of substance, and one that we're committed to already to account for human nature. It also makes good sense of the unity of human minds and bodies, something which, as we'll see, substance dualists have traditionally struggled with. In addition to these sorts of virtues, it also does a good job of upholding common sense views about the materiality of human beings. In particular, it preserves our pre-theoretical conception of ourselves as bodies of a certain type, namely organisms. And for the same reason, it can uphold our intuitions about the goodness of the human body and the badness of death. Along each of these parameters, therefore, materialism clearly has a lot going for it. It needs to be emphasized that materialism is not only the dominant conception of human nature among contemporary philosophers, it's also the conception of choice for many contemporary Christian philosophers. That is, philosophers like Peter Van Inwagen, Lynn Rutter Baker, Hud Hudson, Trenton Merricks, and others, who, like Aquinas, allow their conception of human beings to be influenced by their theology. Nor is it hard to see why. Scripture and tradition themselves seem to offer considerable support for the materiality of human beings. For example, there are biblical passages such as Genesis 3:19, "For dust you are, and to dust you will return," which strongly suggest that we are material substances, or bodies, and indeed that death involves our corruption, or destruction, as such. And there are Christian doctrines like the resurrection of the body and the incarnation of Christ, which also put great emphasis on the goodness of the human body and the badness of human death. As is often pointed out, however, especially by other Christian philosophers and theologians, despite these advantages, materialism is at a serious disadvantage when it comes to preserving common sense and traditional Christian teachings about the immateriality of human beings. In particular, materialism has a hard time accounting for our differences from non-human animals, especially if we take these to include something that Christians and other major monotheists have traditionally insisted on, namely that we somehow bear the image of God. If God is wholly immaterial and we're in his image, then it seems like we must be at least partly immaterial. What's more, materialism has a hard time accounting for traditional Christian views about the immortality of the soul and traditional Christian views of the afterlife. But both of these things also enjoy considerable support from Scripture and tradition. Thus, in addition to passages like that from the Genesis passage quoted a moment ago, there are passages like this one from Ecclesiastes. "The dust returns to the ground it came from, and the spirit returns to God who gave it." And these sorts of passages appear to emphasize our connection to a soul that can exist apart from death. Again, consider Christ's famous words to the thief on the cross who asked Christ to remember him in his kingdom. In response, Christ says, "I tell you the truth, today you will be with me in paradise." This passage is traditionally taken to refer to a time after death and prior to the resurrection, when the thief will exist without a body. This is often referred to as the interim state. Indeed, on the traditional view of the afterlife, rewards and punishments for what we've done in this life will be distributed by God during this interim state. Here's a passage from Aquinas where he clearly commits himself to this traditional view. He says, "Because the souls of human beings are capable of receiving glory or punishment immediately after they have been separated from the body, they will immediately receive one or the other. Neither the reward of the good nor the punishment of the bad is put off until their souls take up their bodies again." Now, obviously, materialism isn't going to be able to handle traditional Christian views of this sort. For anyone committed to traditional Christian views about immortality of the soul and the afterlife, therefore, it might appear that we should abandon materialism in favor of something more like substance dualism. For in that case, we'll be able to make good sense of those aspects of common sense and tradition that uphold the immateriality of human beings. Indeed, I suspect that it's precisely this sort of thought that explains why substance dualism has always been popular among Christians. I guess all those things should be turned blue. Dualism can do good along all of those. Even so, substance dualism appears to have some pretty significant costs of its own. Indeed, it appears to fall short along precisely those parameters that materialism succeeds. It's not theoretically parsimonious. On the contrary, it invokes two types of substance rather than just one. It effectively denies the unity of minds and bodies, saying it amounts to nothing more than a kind of causal connection. It violates the common sense intuition that we're organisms or bodies, saying instead we're immaterial substances. And for the same reason, it seems to minimize both the goodness of the body and the badness of death. We're just sort of kicking off something we were only causally related to. Of these various costs, contemporary materialists often emphasize substance dualism's failure to preserve intuitions about our relationship to our bodies. Trenton Merricks puts the point well. He says, "I think that when you look in the mirror or down at your hands, you can actually see yourself. And when you hold your child, you do exactly that. These claims imply that we are not souls of the sort imagined by substance dualists." I guess a substance dualist says what you see when you look in the mirror is something you have causal control over. When you hug your child, you just bump the thing that you're controlling into the thing that they're controlling. Aquinas, by contrast, tends to emphasize substance dualism's failure to preserve the unity of minds and unity of minds and bodies and the badness of death. Here's a passage where he suggests that these are both problematic on substance dualism. "Plato maintained that the relationship of the soul to the body is like that of a sailor to a ship, or that of one who is clothed to his clothing. But this position can't be upheld. For if the soul were in the body as a sailor in a ship, then it would follow that the unity of the soul and body is accidental. But then death, which brings about their separation, wouldn't be a substantial corruption," which is obviously false. Nothing would really be destroyed. You just have a minor separation of a captain and a ship. And of course, all this might make us wonder whether substance dualism is really better off than materialism after all. In fact, it might make us wonder how both of these first two traditional conceptions compare to our third. As it happens, trialism has not received the sort of detailed analysis or attention from philosophers and theologians that materialism and substance dualism have. I think this is unfortunate, as trialism appears to have a number of things going for it as a conception of human nature. Indeed, it might appear to be the only one capable of doing justice to both the materiality and the immateriality of human beings. Now, admittedly, trialism cannot be regarded as theoretically parsimonious. Indeed, insofar as it appeals to three different types of substance, it's worse off with regards to parsimony than either materialism or substance dualism. What's more, it can't quite preserve the common sense intuition that we are our bodies or organisms, though it can come close by saying that we're composed of bodies or organisms. In almost every other respect, however, trialism is equal, if not superior, to its materialist and dualistic rivals. Thus, insofar as trialism says that we're composed of bodies, it can preserve all the other advantages of materialism, including its other theoretical virtues, the unity of minds and bodies, and its account of the materiality of human beings, including the goodness of the body and the badness of death. And insofar as trialism says that we're composed of immaterial souls, it can also preserve the chief advantages of substance dualism, including our differences from non-human animals, or our being in the image of God, and the immortality of the soul. The only place a question arises has to do with how well trialism can be said to fit with traditional Christian views of the afterlife, and in particular with that interim period of punishment and reward. This turns out to be an important question and one that we'll have to return to since it affects the proper understanding of Aquinas' views. But before we do that, let's first attempt to get clear about Aquinas' own conception of human beings, namely hylomorphism. Aquinas thinks of all reality in broadly Aristotelian terms, and he thinks of the material world in particular in terms of matter and form, or houle and morphe in Aristotle's Greek. It's for this same reason that he conceives of material substances in general, and human beings in particular,
as hylomorphic compounds.
That is, entities composed of both matter, or houle, and form, or morphe. Aquinas' hylomorphic conception of human nature bears important similarities to all three of the conceptions we've been considering. In the end, I don't think it can be properly interpreted in terms of any one of them. Even so, if we want to make progress in understanding his conception, I think there's no better place to begin than with its connection to each of these three others, beginning with
its similarities to materialism.
Like materialists, Aquinas identifies human beings with living bodies or organisms, and like them, he thinks of such bodies or organisms as a type of material substance.
So, on Aquinas' conception, Socrates is identical to a material substance.
What's more, Aquinas thinks of bodies in general as having a special connection to matter, and human minds or souls as having a special connection to form. Indeed, in the case of human beings, he identifies the soul with a part of the body, namely one that makes the body alive and endows it with the capacity for rational thought and volition. So he's thinking of it as a kind of part. In principle, one could take such a part to be wholly material, such as the brain. In light of all this, it might seem that Aquinas' hylomorphism is best understood as a type of materialism. But in fact, this can't be right, for reasons that become clear from its similarities to substance dualism. Although Aquinas thinks of forms as parts of bodies, he does not think of them as ordinary material parts, such as the brain. Indeed, in the special case of the human soul, he insists that it must be conceived of as a type of immaterial substance.
So it's not
a material part, but an immaterial substance. Indeed, one which survives the death of the body and continues to support rational thought and volition in its absence, even though there is a sense in which it's incomplete without the body, and so a kind of incomplete substance. What's more, Aquinas makes it clear that he takes the human body, which is a material substance, and the human soul, which is an immaterial substance, to be the only two types of substance required to account for our nature as human beings. In light of this, it might seem that Aquinas' hylomorphism is best understood as a type of substance dualism rather than materialism. But in fact, this can't be right either,
for reasons that become clear from its
similarities to trialism. As we have seen, substance dualists identify human beings with their souls, and hence take them to be wholly immaterial beings. As we've also seen, however, Aquinas rejects this identification, insisting instead that human beings must be identified with their bodies, and so are themselves material substances. What's more, Aquinas insists that human beings are not only distinct from their souls, but possess them in a way that a whole possesses its parts. But this in turn requires that human beings are at least partly immaterial beings for him. Indeed, as Aquinas sees it, human beings are partly material and partly immaterial beings, composed of both matter and form, or body and soul, when these two things are appropriately related such as to, united in such a way as to produce a new substance. Now, it might be wondered why Aquinas describes human beings as material substances, given that they're composed at least partly of an immaterial substance, or soul. The answer is that, as he's using the term, something qualifies as material just in case it possesses matter. This is what distinguishes human beings, as well as all other creatures in the material world, from God and the angels, who are wholly immaterial. Even so, since Aquinas thinks of human beings as unique in possessing both material and immaterial parts, it would be better, I think, to characterize them
as complex
substances on his conception, as trialists do, rather than merely as material or immaterial substances, as materialists and substance dualists do. Indeed, as we can now see, Aquinas conceives of the relation between the matter and form of the human being in the same way that trialists conceive of the relation between the human body and soul, namely, as a relation that holds between distinct things that are united to each other in such a way as to compose a further substance. In light of all this, it might seem that in the end, Aquinas' hylomorphism is best understood as a form of trialism. But in fact, even this can't be right,
for reasons that become clear
from the differences that Aquinas' views have from all three conceptions. Insofar as Aquinas conceives of human beings as having material and immaterial parts that are related via something like substantial union, his conception of human nature obviously comes close to that of the trialists. Even so, there's an important difference. Unlike the trialists, Aquinas does not conceive of the material part of the human being as another substance. Indeed, what he calls the matter of a human being is best thought of not as a substance, but as a kind of stuff out of which material substances or bodies are made. Substances are things that can exist on their own, but stuffs can't. We might indicate this lack of independence by putting dotted lines around the box for matter. Now, the fact that Aquinas takes human beings to be bodies, having both material and immaterial parts, leads him to think of human bodies themselves as only partly material substances. And this, in turn, distinguishes his hylomorphism not only from trialism, but also from materialism and substance dualism. For the proponents of all three of these traditional conceptions take for granted that human bodies are wholly material substances. In the end, therefore, I think that Aquinas's hylomorphic conception of human beings must be understood in a way that distinguishes it from each of the other conceptions we've considered. And I've indicated this at F on your handout, where I've also stated it in terms of five claims. On Aquinas' hylomorphism, first of all, there are exactly two types of substance required to count for our human nature, partly material substances and wholly immaterial substances. Our bodies are partly material substances. Our minds or souls are wholly immaterial substances. We're identical to our bodies and possess our minds or souls as well as our matter or material stuff as parts. And finally, we are by nature partly material and partly immaterial beings. In short, I think it's clear that Aquinas's hylomorphism does provide us with a distinctive conception of human beings, one which, for the same reasons I'll now try to explain, is both historically and philosophically
significant.
This characterization of Aquinas's hylomorphism, the one I've just given you, is historically significant insofar as it provides us with a novel interpretation of his views. Philosophers have often wondered how best to characterize Aquinas' conception of human beings. I think it's fair to say, moreover, that their dispute has focused on the question of whether we should think of his conception
as a type of substance dualism.
Non-historians, especially those in the analytic tradition, tend to lump Aquinas together with the substance dualists because of his views about the immortality of the soul, though I know of at least one person who's identified him as a trialist. By contrast, historians of philosophy, and especially Thomistic commentators, have typically taken the opposite view, insisting that whatever else Aquinas is, he is not a substance dualist because of his denial that human beings are their souls. Indeed, historians of philosophy typically agree that Aquinas' conception marks out a distinctive position midway between materialism and substance dualism, disagreeing, if at all, only on the precise relationship of these two extremes. If my interpretation is right, however, both parties go wrong in thinking of Aquinas' hylomorphism solely in terms of its connection to materialism and substance dualism. I agree with both parties in thinking that Aquinas' views can't be understood in terms of materialism. And I agree with the historians against the non-historians in thinking that they can't be understood in terms of substance dualism. Though, to be fair, non-historians sometimes use the term in an exceedingly broad sense. Even so, I think that if Aquinas' views are going to be located on the cusp between any two views, they ought to be located on that between substance dualism and trialism, rather than materialism and substance dualism. As these remarks about the historical significance of Aquinas' hylomorphism help to bring out, his views are also philosophically significant, marking out a distinctive position whose possibility has been almost entirely overlooked in the contemporary context. For the sake of clarity, I've included a table at G on the handout highlighting the precise relationship of hylomorphism to the other three conceptions. And I use shading to indicate similarities and the absence of shading to indicate differences. As this table is intended to make clear, Aquinas' hylomorphism shares some important similarities with all three traditional conceptions, despite being distinct from each.
In particular,
it shares the most in common with trialism, including its account of both the nature of human beings and their relationship to souls. It shares the next most in common with substance dualism, including the number of different types of substance it posits to account for our nature as human beings. And it shares just one important thing in common with materialism, namely the identification of us with our bodies. Though even here, hylomorphism departs from materialism in thinking of human bodies as only partly material. The distinctive nature of Aquinas' hylomorphism gives it, I think, some distinctive advantages as a conception of human beings, at least along the parameters we've been considering. Here I would refer you to the table at H on the handout, which will remind you of the relevant parameters and also show you how all four conceptions fare relative to one another. Given what I said earlier about trialism's advantages as a conception of human beings, I think it's especially significant that Aquinas' hylomorphism shares all of the advantages of trialism, but none of its distinctive costs. Note that Aquinas' hylomorphism also does better, at least in terms of sheer number of advantages, than either materialism or substance dualism. There can be no doubt that hylomorphism is worse off than materialism when it comes to theoretical parsimony, but this is the only respect in which it's worse off. And in any case, materialism won't be a live option for anyone committed to upholding the immortality of the soul, much less the immateriality of human beings. This suggests that at least when it comes to the parameters we're considering, the real choice is between hylomorphism and substance dualism. But even here, hylomorphism might appear to be the clear victor, since only it can do justice to both the materiality and immateriality of human beings. Can we conclude, therefore, that hylomorphism is the best overall conception of human beings? Not quite. As I noted earlier, there is still a question about how well hylomorphism fares relative to substance dualism when it comes to the afterlife, especially that interim state. Before we can make any final decisions, therefore, we must address the question of the afterlife head on. Let's briefly turn, therefore, to Aquinas' views about human death. Death, as I've been thinking of it, is just the separation of the soul from the body. Insofar as Aquinas accepts the immortality of the soul, he's obviously committed to saying that the soul survives this separation. But what about the whole human being? When Socrates' soul separates from his matter, does Socrates himself survive? This question turns out to be difficult to answer for Aquinas, since to my knowledge, he never explicitly addresses it. Even so, we can distinguish two models of human death corresponding to the two possible answers he could give. Both models will obviously presuppose his hylomorphism. So consider again Socrates, who's a complex substance for Aquinas, composed of both matter and a soul. Moreover, let's begin by considering him at some time prior to his death. And for good measure, we can also add in a time at which he will later be resurrected. Now, according to the first model, which I'll refer to as cessationism, when human beings die, they utterly cease to exist. Thus, when Socrates dies, say as a result of drinking the hemlock, and his soul separates from his matter, Socrates himself goes out of existence, only to return at the general resurrection of the dead, when his separated soul is reunited with matter. Here's my attempt to illustrate that. Here's Socrates approaching death. Oh! He died, his soul continues. Oh, it comes back. There we are. All right, so that's cessationism at a glance. By contrast, according to the second model, which I'll refer to as survivalism, human beings survive their death along with their separated rational souls. Thus, what goes out of existence when Socrates' soul separates from his matter isn't Socrates, but only his body. Likewise, what returns at the general resurrection of the dead when his separated soul is reunited with matter, is not Socrates, he's been there all along, but only Socrates' body. So here's an attempt to illustrate the second one. Socrates is approaching death, his soul separates from matter, but Socrates survives during the interim. Now the soul comes back to some matter. And Socrates is embodied again. I've given you definitions of these two models, as well as a snapshot illustration of them at each of the three times on your handout. You can see this at I and L on the handout. Assuming the basic distinction between these two models is clear, the $1 million question is once again, which of them is best? I think it's fair to say that Aquinas' commentators nowadays typically interpret his hylomorphism in terms of that first model, the cessationist model of human death. Indeed, cessationism is often referred to in the secondary literature as the standard interpretation. Nor is it hard to see why. It appears to be straightforwardly entailed by what Aquinas says about the materiality of human beings, and even more specifically about our nature as bodies
and the badness
of human death. Here's why. Insofar as we just are our bodies, it would seem that we must go out of existence when we die. For Aquinas thinks it's clear that our bodies are corrupted or destroyed
when we die.
Again, in order to explain the badness of death, Aquinas thinks we must say that when we die, we undergo a substantial change. Death is not like stepping off a ship or changing your clothes. In fact, it's not an accidental change of any sort. It's a substantial change or corruption. But it's hard to see how a human being can undergo a change of this sort without ceasing to exist altogether. Despite these two pieces of evidence in its favor, cessationism has some pretty serious costs, both as an interpretation of Aquinas and as a model of human death in its own right. Here I'm thinking in particular of what it implies about the afterlife. And there are two problems here, both having to do with traditional Christian views of the afterlife. The first is what I'll call the problem of postmortem thinking and willing. Aquinas is emphatic that when my soul is in the body, it's not my soul that thinks or wills, but the whole human being, me. But what about after death, when my soul continues to exist and to support thought and volition? Evidently, if cessationism is true, my soul must begin doing some things it's never done prior to that point, namely thinking and willing on its own, since I won't be there to do it. And evidently, my soul must also later leave off doing these same things once I'm resurrected, since I'll be there again to do them myself. This is made all the more strange by the fact that cessationists themselves admit that my soul is not itself a person for Aquinas. But how can anything other than a person ever think? Closely related to this first problem is a second one concerning postmortem punishment and reward. As we've seen, Aquinas thinks that immediately following death, someone or something is punished or rewarded for the deeds that I performed in life. But if cessationism is true, it can't be me, since I won't be around. Actually, this is why I would like cessationism to be true. Hence, it must be my soul, since it appears to be the only thing that could take my place. But here again, this is a very strange consequence, especially if we add again, as the cessationist must, that the soul is not itself a person. But how can anyone other than me be punished or rewarded for my deeds? And even if we could make sense of another person being punished or rewarded in my place, how are we to make sense of it in the case of the soul? Now, to be fair, at least some of Aquinas' interpreters are aware of these problems and have come up with some ingenious suggestions for reconciling cessationism both with Aquinas' texts and with traditional Christian teachings about the afterlife. Even so, I think the problems with this model of human death are significant enough to warrant a closer look at our other model,
namely
survivalism. Survivalism has the advantage of avoiding precisely the problems that plague cessationism. According to the survivalists, I survive my death, so there's no question about who does my thinking or willing after death. I do. Nor is there any question about who's punished or rewarded for my deeds in life. I am. The problem for survivalism, however, is how to reconcile it with the very considerations that motivate cessationism in the first place, in particular with what Aquinas' hylomorphism says about the materiality of human beings. After all, how could we survive our death if we're just our bodies, but they don't survive? Or how could we survive if dying itself requires us to undergo a substantial change? As it turns out, I think we get answers to both of these questions if we consider them in light of certain things Aquinas says about the incarnation. So, very briefly, let us consider Aquinas' understanding of this doctrine. According to the Christian doctrine of the incarnation, God became a human being. More specifically, at a certain point in time and in the person of Christ, God took on human nature, thereby became fully human without ceasing to be fully divine, lived out a perfectly sinless life, eventually suffered and died, but on the third day was resurrected from the dead. Obviously, this is a complicated doctrine, but I want to focus merely on Aquinas' understanding of what was involved when God, in Christ, became human, died, and was resurrected. So let's look at each of these things, beginning with the first. In line with tradition going back at least to the 5th century, with the Council of Chalcedon, Aquinas takes the doctrine of the Incarnation to apply that when Christ became human, he did so by taking on a body and soul. Or more precisely for Aquinas, he took on matter and a soul, and thereby became a certain type of substance, namely a human body. Okay, but what about when he died? Here again, in line with tradition, Aquinas assumes that when Christ died, his soul was separated from his matter, and hence he ceased to be a human being. But after 3 days, he was resurrected. When he was resurrected, his soul was reunited with matter, and hence he became a human being again. As these brief remarks suggest, Aquinas is thinking of the Incarnation and Christ's death in particular along the lines of survivalism. Christ is God, so obviously when he dies, he doesn't cease to exist altogether. That would be impossible. On the contrary, he merely ceases to be a certain type of material substance or body, namely a human being. But if Christ ceases to be a certain type of substance when he dies, then he clearly undergoes a substantial change. And of course, something similar happens when he's resurrected and once again becomes a human being. This survivalist model of the Incarnation gives us all we need to solve our initial problem about how to reconcile survivalism with what hylomorphism says about the materiality of human beings. When Christ becomes human, he becomes a certain type of material substance, and when he dies, he ceases to be that same type of substance, even though he doesn't thereby cease to exist.
So why couldn't the same be true of us?
Likewise, Christ undergoing a substantial change at death doesn't require him to cease to exist. Once again, therefore, why should it be any different for us? Indeed, insofar as Christians have always taken Christ's death and resurrection to be a sort of model for understanding our own, as Paul suggests in 1 Corinthians 15, a commitment to the Incarnation would seem to provide at least some indirect support for survivalism.
There is, however, a remaining problem.
On Aquinas' hylomorphism, it belongs to our very nature to be material. In fact, Aquinas says as much at various places. But if that's true, it's hard to see how we could be material at one time, immaterial at another, as the survivalist model seems to require. Indeed, it might be thought that it is only because Christ is divine rather than human, by nature, that he can be material at one time, immaterial at another, and hence that the survivalist model applies only to him. But the problem here, I think, is more terminological than anything. Aquinas does say at various places that it belongs to the nature or essence of human beings to be material, but he also makes the same sort of claims about the human soul, even though it's clear that he thinks the soul can exist apart from the body.
Consider, for example, the following passage.
The soul is naturally united to the body since it belongs to its nature to be the form of a body. It is therefore contrary to the nature of the soul to be absent from the body. But nothing which is contrary to nature can continue forever. Hence, the soul can't continue forever without a body. As passages such as this one make clear, to say that it belongs to the nature or essence of the soul to be in the body just means that it's contrary to the nature of the soul to be separated from it. I think we should interpret Aquinas' claims about the connection between human beings and their matter or bodies in the same way. And if we do, then survivalism will not even be in conflict with what hylomorphism requires about our partly material nature. Okay, time to bring this talk to a close. Let's consider what we're able to conclude at this point. First, with regard to survivalism and cessationism. I think it's clear that survivalism provides us with a better hylomorphic model of human death than cessationism. There's nothing to prevent us from interpreting Aquinas' hylomorphism in terms of survivalism. On the contrary, there's both textual and systematic grounds for doing so. What's more, if we do interpret his views in this way, we can avoid all those knotty problems having to do with the afterlife, the soul's thinking and willing, being punished or rewarded on our behalf, etc. And that seems like a good thing, both in itself and for what it tells us about hylomorphism versus substance dualism. Remember, we had this question about how hylomorphism fares relative to substance dualism when it comes to the afterlife. But if what I've just said is correct, the answer should be clear. Hylomorphism fares just as well as substance dualism with respect to the afterlife, at least when interpreted along survivalist lines. But then, doesn't it just follow that hylomorphism, so interpreted, provides the best overall conception of human beings, at least along the parameters we've been considering? Not quite. For it must be recognized that the survivalist interpretation of hylomorphism does bring with it an important cost, namely the requirement that a complex object, namely a human being, can be composed at least temporarily of just a single part, namely its soul. This is a strange consequence, to say the least. Indeed, one might even think it's incoherent. For if an object is complex, that is to say, if it has parts at all, it might appear to be impossible for it to have just one part. At this point, however, we must be careful. Aquinas can allow that it's impossible for an object to be composed of a single part throughout its entire career. His view doesn't require that. What it requires is merely this. An object that starts off having multiple parts can come temporarily to be composed of just one of them. And that, I submit, is not incoherent. Strange? Yes. Surprising? Definitely. But impossible? No. Or so it seems to me. I realize, of course, that not everyone will share my enthusiasm for the survivalist model of human death, or even for the type of hylomorphism that underlies it. In fact, I can easily imagine that reflection on the very same considerations that lead me to embrace both might well tip the balance for someone else in favor of another conception, or perhaps even cessationism. I do, however, hope at least to have convinced you of the significance of Aquinas' views on our topic, as well as the value of approaching human nature and death from the perspective of his broadly Aristotelian hylomorphism. If my interpretation is correct, his views seem to stake out a number of dialectical options that have yet to receive the attention they deserve, as well as to identify a host of considerations that must be evaluated if we are to arrive at the truth about what happens to us after death. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.